My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest won the Military Cross for his actions in the recovery of a fallen commando. This recovery mission will go down in legend as the time three Royal Marines and a Royal Engineer strapped themselves to an Apache and flew into the Hornet's Nest. Episode 31, Dave Rigg. This is Declassified. So joined the army in 2001, went to Sandhurst, after Sandhurst, troop commander's course as a Royal Engineer. And then was the plan always then to do the All Arms Commando course?
I was actually sponsored through Sandhurst by the Paras. And then kind of halfway through Sandhurst thought, well, actually, Engineers offers me more options. And so when I decided to join the Engineers, I was intent on either going down the Para route or the Commando route. Mm. And the All Arms course came up and... So I snatched it up.
How does it work with the officers then? Is it a limited number of officers?
Yeah, well, it's a combination of, like, you know, availability and desire. Mm. And I made it pretty clear that, you know, one do one or the other. And there happened to be places at 5-9 Commando. So that's the way I went.
Mm. Good course.
Great course, yeah. You've got to do the beat up first, which I think it's changed a bit now, but 5-9 want to make sure that they're sending down the best blokes, because those guys represent 5-9 Commando and the Royal Engineers, and you're on the course with, you know, gunners and loggies and all sorts of other guys. And I think all the corps do the same thing. Everyone puts, you know, kind of gives the boys a good thrashing before they send down to the commando course. So actually, you're pretty well prepared by the time you got down to the commander course. I know on my beat up, 12 started and 2 finished. So I got this awesome course photo of, there's about 4 DS and just two students.
And was that before the course then started?
That was before the end of the beat up, before the commander course.
Yeah.
Just two remaining engineer lads. Yeah.
And then joining, so then after the All Arms course, you went to 5-9.
Yeah.
What's that, the
2003 that was. So Telec 1 had kicked off and I was sent straight into theatre to catch the tail end of Telec 1. Mm. And I think that's all. I mean, I didn't really see much action other than a lot of naked Marines running around playing volleyball. But I got a medal for it, which was a bit of a disgrace.
Yeah, modern day war fighting, naked Marines and a lot of volleyball.
Yeah, well, they're good looking lads, you know.
These are timed good then, so you did 3 years.
Oh, it was brilliant, I loved it, you know. Really high calibre soldier, really motivated. You're based down in North Devon, which was fantastic, so we're doing troop fizz on the beach. And access to the winter warfare course and all the training that the bootnecks do. Mm. Did the army dive course. Initially, I was one troop commander, and then I moved on to support troop commander. And then I did a stint as ops officer.
Was you a captain then when you left?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
3 years with 5-9.
Yeah.
Left as a captain. And why do you have to leave after 3 years? Or do you have to leave?
Yeah, they just move you around, don't they? It's the way the Royal Engineers work. They've got to, I guess, for your career to progress, you've got to move on to other more senior positions. You can't. We were just a squadron, so there's just there weren't some those positions weren't just weren't available. So I went to 2A Engineer Regiment in Hamel.
Mm. And different. What was the difference?
Yeah.
Cultural.
Oil and water. But good, you know, great. I had a fantastic time in Germany. The soldiers were slightly less physical, but you know, very professional, motivated, and probably slightly more disgusting in some ways. But I think that comes with sticking a load of blokes out in a camp miles away from home, and they bond in an unusual way.
We'll leave that, mate, for another one. I was at 3-5 down the road, and very similar experiences. The went on Herrick six or one of the Herricks in 2006.
Yeah, I think it was Herrick four. Thing about it was 2006. Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. So
the start of that.
Well, it was shortly after John Reid made that famous announcement that we were going to go into Afghanistan and resolve the problem over there without a shot being fired. And that primarily it was going to be a reconstruction tour. So we're going to go in there, build capacity, rebuild infrastructure and provide the foundations for good governance. But there were other themes as well. You know, there was counter-terrorism, there was counter-narcotics, and there was nation-building. So we were trying to tackle those three strands simultaneously, which is very difficult because, you know, counter-narcotics means going and effectively on the ground, you're burning poppy fields and taking away the livelihood of the local people. Mm. If you take away someone's means of earning a crust and you're doing it in the name of the government, it's difficult to build, you know, to develop the nation building theme. So it was all a bit confused.
Mm. And the engineer, because that's, I'm assuming that's like the battle group task. What was the engineer task within it? So 2-8 Engineer Regiment are going to do...
Yeah, so 2-8 Engineer Regiment were primarily the kind of construction group. There was also... It happened to be a Royal Marine tour, so it was a 3 Commando Brigade were out there. Well, we picked up the tail end of air assault, 16 air assault.
Mm.
Yeah. So we picked the tail end of that, and then it rolled into 3 Commando Brigade. And so I had 5-9 back out there with us, and those guys were doing the combat engineer stuff. So working with the infantry in clearing obstacles and providing basic fortifications on the ground in the FOBs and that. And then 2-8 were providing the specific deliberate construction tasks, so building police checkpoints and schools and community centres and stuff like that to help improve the infrastructure and improve people's lives.
And in what area is this? Like a village, a town, like compact? What? How is
all over Helmand? So is it? You know,
the regiment split.
The regiment split, and we've got guys. We've got our headquarters. It started in Kandahar, then moved to Lashkar Gah, and then Bastion was kind of established later. So all the troops from Bastion, but the headquarters was down in Lashkar Gah because that was where the governor was based, the governor of Helmand. And the engineers were all over Helmand. You know, sometimes we had jobs up in Sangin, other times it was Goresh. It just depended on and there's quite a lot going on in Lashkar Gah, which was a permissive area at that time. Lashkar Gah was relatively, you know, they're on side. The Taliban weren't operating in Lashkar Gah, and it was a good place to kind of demonstrate progress and build support. Mm. Yeah.
Are you on the ground at this point? What's your role there?
Mostly, no, I wasn't. probably safe to be on the ground. I was in the headquarters. I was the regimental ops officer, so just banging out op orders and planning and analyzing all of the mapping and imagery and looking at, we got involved in a lot of the psyops and kind of intelligence assessments as well, but mostly doing the prep for the operations.
So there's a construction task to be done. You're planning that, is that almost like an ops room, like an office?
With the other brigade staff.
Yeah.
And then the orders go down to the engineer squadron.
Yeah.
And they then disseminate their detail their bit and disseminate instructions down to the troops. So it starts at the at brigade level and the orders filter down, and I was working at brigade level.
Mm. And then, you know, I'm trying to piece it together, like what was the threat level, because you said it was good, Lashkar Gah was a good place to be, but was there a threat, was any of the tasks in high risk areas, what was going on?
Yeah, there were. I mean, there was Sangin was a really bad place to be, Down in Garmsir was, another hostile environment that was primarily controlled by the Taliban. Nadali wasn't too bad, but still a bit iffy. And the guys, when the guys were carrying out construction tasks, they were getting shot at, and there were mortars coming in, and the bootnecks were working hard to maintain their security.
Mm.
Because as soon as you put a load of troops on the ground, they just became a target, a magnet for the bad guys to come in and whack you. But we were pretty well prepared. They were good, well planned, deliberate ops. In Lashkar Gah, we were just worried about suicide bombers and fairly small scale but high impact attacks.
So at that time, the main threats were suicide bombers and just coming under attack from like small arms or mortars,
rockets,
not so much IED at this point.
IEDs really were there, definitely. IEDs were there, but in our immediate area, the IED threat wasn't too high.
Yeah.
We were doing our best to avoid road moves, but at that time we didn't have a lot in the way of support helicopters, so road moves were inevitable, and most of the FOBs were supplied via road move. Diesel and water and ammunition and all that shit was moving by road.
There were planned operations as well, in brackets, like attacks as well. There was intelligence gathering that then led to the Marines going in and kind of sorting people out. There was clusters of these of strongholds, wasn't there, Taliban? And I'm saying it for a reason. Fast forward us to January now, so we're about 4 months in, like that.
Yeah.
January the 18th, is that right?
14th, January the 14th it was. Yeah.
14th, 2007.
Yeah.
Could you take us, I suppose, from early morning and just start the...
Yeah, well, so this is the attack on Jogram Fort, right? And Jogram Fort was imagine a typical medieval fort, and that was Jogram Fort. It had like a big perimeter wall, it had an inner wall, it had watchtowers on the corners. There were various compounds within, and the intelligence that we had indicated that there were up to 200 men in and around the area that could be a threat. It was reckoned to be a staging post for Taliban recruits coming up from Pakistan, you see. So it was quite far. It was south of Garmsir, so quite far south, just adjacent on the east side of the River Helmand. And we reckoned we've been looking at it for a long time, and it was definitely strategically important to neutralize them, because they were, that's where all the recruits were coming in and then going up, trained and armed into the rest of Helmand, causing chaos. So we decided that we had to do something about it. But there were too many. It was too well fortified, and there were too many blokes there for us to directly attack it. So we developed a plan so I'd been seconded now to the battle group that were working in Helmand province, which is a battle group that was created for that tour, called the IX battle group. Mostly raw Marines, but we had scimitars, and there were 105 light guns, and Brigade Reconnaissance Force was bolstering it. So it was about 500 blokes all in supporting this battle group. And I'm the battle group engineer. So we developed a plan, and it had basically us boys forming a defensive line on the west bank of the River Helmand, and just probing the enemy defences. Rules of engagement pretty tight, so we can't hammer the place without positively IDing firing points. So we'd spotted a few likely firing points, and we were going to probe those, and then just watch for a response. And then we had air assets as well on Apaches, primed to hit them hard, and try and neutralize the capability, but from a distance. Yeah. So we were battle group, kind of, they'd been down in the desert. We'd set up a mini FOB out in the desert, about 5 kilometers west of the fort. And recce guys have been out checking it out, keeping an eye on it. It was fairly quiet. Big question was how we actually, if we had to go in, how would you go in? Because the River Helm is quite a significant obstacle. And the boys had identified a ford across the river that the local farmers were using for getting the tractors back and forth. See, so we had this one crossing point if we needed it. We conducted all our battle prep out in the desert. Zulu Company were the infantry company that were, you know, the boots on the ground. As the kind of prep developed, this be prepared to instruction kind of entered the orders process. And it was, you know, so we were going to, the primary order was to just probe the enemy defences. Yeah, I can't remember the correct term. But then there was a be prepared to dominate the ground should the opportunity arise.
And so to go on.
Yeah, dominate the ground, so put boots on the ground and close and contact the enemy, you know, in the fort, basically. Mm. So strictly the battle group should have been in their preparations and rehearsals should have been rehearsing that order. And I'm not sure that it was ever fully rehearsed, really taken that seriously, simply because the intelligence was pretty clear that it was well fortified and they had too many blokes. You know, there's no way we had the 3-to-1 ratio that you would need for attacking a position like that. On the night of the 13th, the boys all moved into positions and. HR was, I don't know, about 1 o'clock in the morning or something. And we just started firing into those known, you know, positions where we'd seen sentries with weapons. So all predefined firing points and started probing those. And there was very little coming back at us. You know, it was pretty quiet. And that carried on for a couple of hours, I guess. And we've got assets in the sky with video feed beamed into. So we're the battle group headquarters. The staff, the headquarters staff, are in a tent in the desert, about 5 kilometers west. And we're watching the video feed, and we're listening to the radios. But the video feed's a bit grainy, so you haven't got a great situational awareness. So you're reliant upon what the guys tell you on the radio. And it was pretty quiet. So this CO conferred with his ops officer and decided that we were going to carry out that be prepared to order to go in and dominate the ground. And that seemed reasonable because there was just bugger all happening. It looked like we had the guns. You know, we had a hell of a lot of firepower lined up. So it didn't, at the time, it didn't seem that unreasonable thing to do.
How many blokes on the ground? How many Royal Marines are?
Royal Marines, probably about, I don't know, with their bolstered with some engineers and a few other bits and pieces, probably about 70.
Oh, okay.
I might have that order of magnitude. I don't quite
precise, but roughly.
A few years ago, but.
Yeah.
It was a company. It was a company minus, so 70 might be, maybe it's 50, but we called the OC, Zulu Company OC, and the Viking commander. So the guys were moving around in these vehicles called Vikings, tracked armored vehicles, and so called them back, delivered some quick battle orders, and. Pretty rapid process. I briefed on the ground. Everyone was clear. It was simple. We knew where to cross. Plan was just to send the Vikings straight up, mount up the Vikings and straight across the river, across that 40 points, fast as you can, single file, fan out on the there was like a bit of dead ground just immediately in front of the outer wall, and it was kind of soft ploughed field basically. And the boys are going to kind of fan out there, and then move to the perimeter wall, and it was then down to the commander on the ground to respond appropriately depending on where the enemy was. So they mounted up, and we could see them, you know, from the video feed. You could see the Vikings steaming across the river, and they're really going for it.
Mm.
And it's still quiet. There's not much. Scimitars are covering. We've got Apache watching. There's not much going on. But as soon as the first Viking hit the far bank of the river, just all hell broke loose. You know, the enemy just let rip with everything they had. And clever, you know, they've been waiting until the Marines were within the effective range of their weapon systems.
Mm.
And once they were, so pretty disciplined, they drew them in, and then knowing that if they were going to attack, they knew where they were going to come from, and just focused all their firepower upon them. So the Viking top gunners have got Jimpies and they're blatting away. Now that we can see the firing points, you can see on the video feed, the place just comes alive with, because we've got these infrared cameras, you can just see all the firing points.
Because you're a few miles back.
We're in the ops. About 5K back. But you can see on the video feed that it's all of a sudden, you know, these dark pictures just livened up with bits of light everywhere, which is where all the firing points were. And then you start getting all the contact reports through on the radio. So but there's bugger all we can do in the we're just watching, and it's down to the commands on the ground now to respond appropriately. Obviously the guys controlling the air and the guns are providing orders for their guys so that the covering fire is going in. And then the first Marines to debus got hit. So there's three guys with gunshot wounds, pretty much like that. And, you know, every guy takes two blokes to sort out. So that first section's just rendered totally useless. And then we've lost the momentum. And it then starts to go tits up pretty quick. Because even those that weren't hit were pinned down, and there was a lot of incoming. It was just open ground. I mean, when I say dead ground, there was a slight kind of reverse slope on the ground leading into the river. So on one side you got the river, and the other side you got a load of bad guys heavily tooled up.
And with one entry and exit point as well. Like.
Yeah, yeah. So, but the Vikings keep coming. So the boys are just piling up on the ground east of the river in front of the fort, and they're just going, getting on the belt buckle and trying to.
Is all the firepower from the lads, or is there anything else coming in? Is there anything coming in from the air?
So the Apaches are now putting in supporting fire, we're dropping ordnance, 500 pounders on. Unidentified, so it's really hot now.
Mm.
But they're well dug in, and they're concealed, so it was really hard to pinpoint them. And the other problem is, you know, there's loads of cultivated ploughed fields around, so it's clear that the area is populated with civilians. And so, you know, you're worried about collateral. So there's only so much, and that when we're so close to the enemy, and you got all those kind of collateral issues, it's very difficult for the air power to actually have a committed impact, you know. It wasn't going to change. It was going to kind of take the heat off the boys, but it wasn't going to change the situation. I think it didn't go very well. There were other factors that I'm not going to go into now that just meant that the attack just lost its momentum, and the only option then really was to mount an orderly withdrawal and regroup. So Sergeant Major sorted his boys out, got them back into the Vikings, got the casualties back, and evacuated the rest of the boys without any further casualties, which was impressive.
Mm. Good leadership, was it, from him?
Yeah, he was, I don't remember his name, but he was a Brummie, and he was just got about the boys and kicked them up the arse and made it happen, you know.
So got them back out across the river?
Got them off the belt buckles and you know, managed a withdrawal. So,
right, yeah.
You know, they basically have pepper pot back into the vehicles and get out.
Yeah. Are you hearing, sorry to interrupt you there, are you hearing all this on it back in the ops room?
You hear some of it, not so they've got their own net, so the squad, the company are on their own net, so you don't hear all of it, but you hear most of it. Yeah, you hear the high level stuff.
Yeah.
So at this point, I'm kind of, you know, I haven't really got a job, because I've done my bit basically. So I'm just trying to make myself useful. Casualties are coming back, so I'm. Administering some basic first aid and keeping them warm and reassuring them until the CASEVAC comes in. And there were some miraculous scrapes. There's one guy with his Kevlar helmet has just got this massive scrape across the middle where he's basically deflected an RPG. There's another lad who has got the old fashioned kind of cigar case in his breast pocket, and that's got a 7.62 round in it. I mean, most of them only had one gunshot wound, but they had a whole load of other.
Jeez.
You know, the evidence was there that there was a lot more going on. And, they were lucky to get away with it. Anyway. So we're kind of sorting all, trying to sort this out, and Zoo Company doing their reorg, and then rumours start to go round that there's a bloke missing, and you just get this. Well, initially I thought, bollocks, it's just chaotic.
Yeah,
you'll be right. And then it became clear that Corporal Ford had been left on the objective. And then there's just the horrible, sickening feeling that you experience at that point when you realise that, you know, one of the boys has been left in enemy territory. And, you know, you can see now, because we've still got the video feed, there's a hornet's nest. It's just there's bodies coming out of everywhere. And they're running around. It's lively and they're pumped up because they've just effectively won a battle against... you know, the best that the British Army has to throw against them. So they're pumped up and they got one of our guys and it was an awful feeling.
What's the time frame between initially going out, crossing the river, and then now on the back on the withdrawal and then back in and then knowing that this guy's gone missing?
A couple of hours, I guess.
Oh, really? That long?
Yeah. An hour.
Is it light now?
Between an hour and 2 hours. Yeah, so it's gone light now. Yeah, I remember it being light. But it's so, what is it, about 5, 6 in the morning, you realise. But we don't know where he is. We know that, right, so they're now ready waiting for us. We know that the initial intelligence was right, that it's absolutely rammed with... men of fighting age, and we know that there's only one way in. We've got no support helicopters, so we've got to get him out. We've got to go back in across the river, and we didn't really know where he was. We didn't know if they'd collected him, and so while you always go back and you never leave a bloke behind, but at this stage we're like, well, is that a sensible thing to do? You know, is it sensible to risk another dozen lives trying to recover this guy?
But you didn't know if he was alive or dead.
No one knows what's going on at this point. He's not with us. He's obviously... So we deployed one of these good British Army fashion. We got like these little polystyrene UAVs that look like something you get from Hamleys, but got a really good little camera on them, deployed one of those up, and the boys that were operating, the gunners operate those things, although we had an RAF image analyst who was studying the footage. And they used that to identify what they thought was a person. He was slumped over, you know, lying down at the just on the far side of the perimeter wall. So, you know, he's not gone into the compound. He's on the far side of the perimeter wall. There's no one else around. We can see where the nearest enemy are, but they're not moving towards him, so it looks like maybe they haven't spotted him. But he's not moving. So we call on the Apache. They got much better optics, and they confirm that yeah, it's definitely a Royal Marine. And the infrared camera indicates that, you know, he might still be alive. So at that point, it was clear that we've got to get him. Yeah, we know it's. There was no debating that. And the brigade commander's on the blower now to the CO, and he's now driving it as well. And he's you got to go in. You got to get him. So staff officers have to come up with a plan. But it was pretty simple. There's only one way in. We've not got any clever tricks up our in the bag. There's no support helicopter. So we got to use the Vikings. So the Viking commander gets called up, and he gets briefed. I remember briefing him on the ground, showing him where Corporal Ford was and where the enemy were, and you know. He just had to, he was going to take four Vikings straight in. Two were going to fan out, put down, supporting, you know, covering fire. And then the other one was the guys were going to get out and get the casualty in the Viking. And then
How far was he away from the river?
About 300 metres.
Oh, so a big distance. Yeah. Well, a fair old whack.
Yeah, it was that area of ground was quite...
And how close was he to the outer wall?
About 5-10 meters.
Oh, really? Ah, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he'd obviously, I still don't know how. He must have been one of the first guys to dismount, and he'd actually made it to where he was supposed to go.
Mm.
But he got isolated. He was a radio operator, so he had all the kit as well. So yeah, it's pretty frustrating. But now we know, you know, the rules of engagement are less of a problem because we've identified all the firing points and we know they're bad guys. So the guns and the in fact the A-10 Thunderbolts coming in, and they were thumping them as well. And we got Apache. So we've got loads of supporting fire now. So it's not all bad, but it's still a pretty scary prospect.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember feeling. Distinctly, like, well, relieved that I wasn't the Viking commander. But just before he sets off to do it, the Apache guys, one of the, he calls himself Ed Macy. He wrote a book about it, but that's his ghost name. Anyway, we'll call him Ed. Ed calls up the CO, and. Obviously starts briefing him on this plan, right? But at this stage we don't know what's going on, so we're just assuming that there's some more intelligence or something. And he briefs on the plan, the CO has a quick chat with the ops officer, and then we're all called into the tent, and the CO says, right, Apaches have got an alternative plan. They want to stick guys on the Apaches, two guys on each Apache. We're going to put two, so four guys in total, two Apaches going in, and we're going to get them that way. I need some volunteers. Initially, when he said that, I thought, oh, fucking brilliant. You know, we've got some special forces are coming in, and, you know, they got some special drill that they carry out. They're going to go and do it. And there was a moment where I was like mega, mega relieved that someone professional was going to come and sort this out. And then he said, oh, I need some volunteers. And I was like, shit, we've got to do this. So we volunteered, you know, we're partly responsible for the mess, so you felt like obliged to do something about it. So a few of us volunteered. And the CO kind of scans around the tent. He's like, no, you need to be controlling the guns. You're doing recce. You're doing air. And then he got to me. He's like, yeah, Captain Rig, you'll go. I was like,
job.
Oh, fuck. Because I was Buck Shee. Anyway, so, all right, okay. And then moments later, the RSM poked his head in the tent and he'd been sorting out casualties and doing some of the admin. He poked his head in the tent just to kind of get an update. And the CEO goes, yeah, good, RSM, you'll go too. And the RSM's like, yeah, boss.
No idea.
Not a clue, no. And then the other two guys, there was a Marine, Marion Robinson, who was a signaller, and Marine Fraser Perry, I think was another junior signaller.
But he's young, isn't he?
He's only been in the Marines 18
months.
Something
like that.
Probably 19 years old. He actually knew Corporal Four quite well. So those boys... I think Fraser Perry just woken up and his boss said, the CO needs some help, he needs a volunteer. And he's like, okay, boss, yeah, sure. He's like, right, good. Grab your rifle and your web and get over there. Captain Rig will brief you. And so I got the boys, so W1 Hearn, Marine Robinson and Marine Fraser Perry. And I've been working with W1 Hearn. I know the RSM, he's a good lad, and we had a good rapport. Marine Robinson, another good lad, stocky, solid. I was quite happy with him on board. And Fraser Perry, just like, you know, you blow him over in the wind. He was so green. Mm. But you know,
them three Royal Marines are.
Yeah, they're all Royal Marines.
Yeah.
Now, because I've been party to the planning, I'm the one that knows ground and what's going on. So I said, right, boys, we're going to go and get, I don't know, we're going to go and get Corporal Ford, and we're going to go in on the Apaches. And the lads just kind of look back at me wide-eyed. They're like, okay, but not a question, not a hesitation. Yeah, they were in. Regardless, I could have told them that we were going to go in with bayonets and wade across the river. They'd still have done it. It was just, I mean, that's what's phenomenal about.
The thing is that you tried making something worse than what you were doing, almost more. Yeah, there is nothing else. There's no more exaggeration than flying in on the Apaches. But sorry, mate, go on, I'll eat.
So we kind of... You know, leave a moment for it to sink in, and then they're like, okay, how Apaches are, you know, they're helicopter gunships. I don't think they carry passengers. How? I was like, I don't know, lads. The Apaches are coming in. They're going to land. They'll brief us. So, I showed them a map. I said, right, there's a perimeter wall. Court Ford's here, Fraser Perry and I will go together on one Apache. We'll go on the lead. RSM and Ream Robinson, you take the other Apache. As soon as we put down, we'll go forwards to the perimeter wall and take cover there. And then you boys join us, and then we'll pepper pot towards the casualty and evacuate them. Okay, simples. The only detail we didn't have at this stage was, you know, where we were going to go on the Apache and how all that malarkey was going to work out. But anyway, we didn't have much. I mean, it all happened pretty quick. So the Apaches just like swooped over the tents and put down just behind us. And we ran up to the lead Apache, and the canopy swung open, and the pilot kind of leaned out and gave us a thumbs up as if to say, right, boys, are you ready? Let's go. And I was like, no. where, how, what, you know. And he started... like shouting instructions down to us, but the engine's still, but I couldn't hear a word. The engine's still turning, And I was just like, no, no, listen, you've got to get out and we've got to have a brief. I've no idea how this is. So he kind of reluctantly gets out of his aircraft and we go down and find just move away from the helicopters and crouch down in the desert. I sketch out a little map in the sand and, right, helicopter's going to go here, and there's a wall, we're going to go there. And then he explains that we're going to sit on the stubby little wings of the Apache. And there's like a handhold that the pilots use to climb into the canopy, so there's something to hang on to at least. And
you carabined on?
No. and frankly, I don't think anyone really wants to be strapped to the Apache in case something happened. We were quite keen. So at the other end, the last thing we wanted to be next to was the Apache, because it's clearly going to be a massive target. Yeah. So as soon as that Apache came anywhere near the ground, we were off and out of there, you know. And on the way in, you're trying to blend into the thing, hoping that the bad guys don't spot the fact that some like lunatics out on the side of it. So that's all clear, right? Okay, fine, simple. We can sit on the side. Okay, boys, right? You're happy with that? And the RSMs. For a while, he thought it was a wind up, but I think he now realises that you know this is actually happening. And the young lads again, no hesitation, straight in, right? Off we go. So we just took up our positions on the Apache. And I found that it was actually quite comfy. There was a reasonable like seat-sized spot to sit on. I was holding on my left hand on this handhold of my weapon in my right hand. I was somewhere for my left foot on the fuselage, and then I had my right foot resting on the Hellfire rocket rails.
And, standard day out.
It's all right. This is the way you travel. without any hesitation, we take off and we swoop over the tents. And I remember looking down, and the rest of the headquarters staff had all come out, and they're all like, some of them were waving, some were taking photos. I'm like, fuck, it's all right for you guys.
Yeah.
You know.
Had it been done before? In anger?
Not that I know of. I've heard that the Yanks had rehearsed it. It was a drill that they used, but I don't think we'd. Well, I mean, the SF might tell you otherwise, but no.
It wasn't standard practice.
Definitely not.
In regards to kind of a suicide mission and then a very safe kind of road move, where is this sitting in between everything?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I had like this moment, but just between briefing the guys and getting on the Apaches, I had this moment of like mild panic. I was like, wow, this place, you know, we're going back into the enemy objective. It's been really stoked up now. There's bodies everywhere. It's full of bad guys. There's a lot of firepower. It's got to be 50-50 as to whether we pull this off. And then you're back into it, and you've got blokes to organise, and you know, it's down to me to kind of lead.
Was it all very quick turnaround?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So we didn't have time to dwell on it, and you just focus on what you got to do, and then I just kind of felt pretty calm about it. Really, it was kind of accepting that there was no question about it. We had to do this, and actually. You know, what was going to happen? We were going to give it our best shot.
Pictures have been taken, waves are people are waving at you. You then go off. What's that ride like then? What's that initial?
Yeah, pretty smooth. Well, so I've got right behind my head. I've got the engine air intake. So as the engine spools up, you can feel like your helmet being sucked off your head.
Yeah.
So I realised that I had to like. Kind of bend, stoop forwards to avoid blocking the engine and causing God knows what. And then we're flying across the desert at low level. We're about 50 feet. And it's a beautiful day. You know, it's about 15 degrees, sun's up, no clouds. Shepherds and the camels and the goats are all going about their business, oblivious to all the drama that we're now involved in. But then on the horizon, you look across to where the river is, and it's just a complete contrast. There's smoke and dust and fire and the noise of the pre-fires going in. They're getting a good thrashing now. We got 500 pounders and the 105s are going off. The we had another two Apaches provide. So it's absolute carnage. You know, it's just this shroud of dust and smoke over the objective now. I mentioned the problem with the weapon. So, a couple of problems with the weapon, actually, which reluctant to go into, but probably will do. The first one was that, so for 4 months, I've sat in the headquarters, mostly in Lashkargah, just desk jockey, you know, banging away at the keyboard. And my rifle's been collecting dust and crap and all sorts in the rifle rack. And as a good officer, I've not really paid much attention to it because I haven't really needed it. And now all of a sudden I'm like, oh Jesus! Now I need it, and no idea if it's going to work. You know what the SA-80 is like, unless you like give it a lot of TLC, they're pretty temperamental. And I've not test fired it. Oh shit! So I'm like, well. Oh, fucking might as well bang out a few rounds while I can, just to make sure it's working. So I leaned over the wing and fired off a couple of test rounds in quick succession, and it worked beautifully. But the noise of the firing caused the pilots to sort of spin round in their seat, and they're like, "What the fuck's going on?" You could see like the shock on their face. I think they thought I had an ND. So I'm now trying to. Through the canopy indicate, no, I'm just test firing it. It's okay. And they go, no. I think because the empty cases could have been sucked into the engineering tank and then there'd been all sorts of chaos. So they're like going, gesticulating, like, no, giving me like a good bollocking through the canopy. Like, oh, okay, right, fine. Anyway, done now. And at least it works. So we'll carry on. We were supposed to be the lead helicopter, but... chaos reigned and we're now the second helicopter. And we moved across the river, so we're now on the east, but we're south of the objective, and we're tracking in and we're trying to time it so that as the bombs stop, we go in, you know, bosh, straight. As timing was everything, momentum was key. They probably weren't expecting this because, I mean, that was the big advantage to this plan. It was new and unusual. And the lead helicopter just didn't hesitate and dived straight in. The dust hadn't subsided, you know, the visibility was awful. He dives in, they kind of dive down and forwards and disappeared into the dust. And we're a bit more cautious and we come up behind and I can see... down to my right, a copse of trees still smouldering, and there's definitely someone firing from that vicinity as well. So I'm like making like a chameleon on the side of the Apache to try and blend in, and it's a sight. The place has just had an absolute thrashing. Anyway, we carry on. And the visibility cleared a little bit, and it became obvious that we could see where we were going to put down. So we put down on that field in front of the fort, which is where we were supposed to be. But there's now no sign of the other helicopter. I'm like, and then I realised that it had gone in so early that it had overflown the perimeter wall and effectively landed in the Taliban garden now.
Inside the fort.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh no, now there's just two of us. I was like, oh well, fucking we're here now. So as soon as that helicopter approached ground, I was off. I like leapt off the wing and ran as fast as I could to where I knew Corporal Ford was, and I recognised the ground, so it wasn't a problem. And it must have been a 200-meter sprint to Ford, and it was soft ploughed ground, so it was really, it's like running on a soft beach. By the time I got to him, I was absolutely ball bagged. Shouldn't have been really, because I was pretty, even though I'd been sat in the headquarters, I had been doing fizz, but I All right. He's slumped over, you know, by the wall, and I can see a dark patch covering most of his back. And I kneel down beside him and roll him over, and his face is just grey, and he's got like this hole in his head, and he's definitely dead. And I suppose in a way that was simpler because I just had to go and get him back.
Mm.
And you can just, there's just a lot of gunfire going on now.
From both sides?
Yeah. I mean, the Apaches are, the Apaches are firing the 30mm cannon into enemy positions.
Oh, the Apaches are firing?
Yeah, so well, the two others.
Ah, right, okay.
There's two supporting in the air, right? And the brass cases are pretty much landing around my ears.
Fuck.
It's that close. So the deafening noise of the Apache and... but they're putting stuff back and there's mortars coming back. But it's not very well aimed. They're just having pot shots because they've clearly got their heads down.
Mm.
But you're not thinking very straight at this point. I can just hear a lot of gunfire and I'm like, oh, I've got to get out of here. So I tried to lift Court forward and I couldn't, in training when you do the old fireman's carry, and we do it on the commando course, it's one of the commando tests. You've got to run 100 metres with a casualty on your back, and they got all their kit on. Well, they got fighting order, and we got fighting order. I never had a problem with that. You know, physically I was pretty strong, but I couldn't even lift the guy. I think he was a big lad. He's probably about 14 stone, and he still had his radio kit on, and you know, a reasonable sized Bergen as well as all his fighting order. So he's heavy. I'm like, right, I just have to drag him. But instead of just grabbing his webbing and dragging him back I put my arms like under his arms, and I was kind of trying to protect his head and get him back, you know, gently. I don't know why.
Mm.
I'm making slow progress, and can you imagine? You're bent down, you're kind of walking backwards, trying to get this dead body back, and it was hard. And then Fraser Perry joined me, and I still don't know what the delay was, but it was really good to have somebody else there. Mm. So I was kind of lifted my spirits. I was like, right. But I was I'm a senior bloke, so he's just following my lead, and he sees me basically baby carrying this guy back, and he then grabs his boots and lifts his boots, which is no good because the heavy bit was the other end. But I should have just, I should have just gripped it and grabbed his web in the air. Fraser Perry went on side and me.
Was he a respect thing there? Like respecting this guy's body? If he'd have been alive and screaming, would you have been...
I think my drills were rusty. And 1 minute I'm in the headquarters, planning and doing paperwork. And the next minute I'm on an enemy objective and there's, all hell's breaking loose. I just hadn't really adjusted. I hadn't...
Yeah, acclimatised to it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're really making a hash of this, and the clock is ticking, and it must have been painful to watch because the guys on the other side are all watch this. My rifle kept like falling off my shoulder and smacking him in the head every time I bent down. Rifle fall off my shoulder, hit him in the head. And I couldn't take that. So I thought, oh, fuck it. I can't use my rifle anyway. So I put my rifle down, which is the last thing you ever do as a soldier. You know, it's just like a cardinal rule. You never put your rifle down.
Mm.
Anyway, so I put my rifle down, and we're getting there, but it's slow. And Ed sees this kind of shambles going on. So he leaps out of the helicopter and runs to us and basically takes charge and says, right, grab him by the webbing. And so three of us then run back with him. And And yeah, once we'd kind of been shown how to do it and we're thinking straight, it all happened pretty quick. And got him back to the helicopter, attached. We had this like green canvas strap, so we put it around his torso, hooked him onto the undercarriage. And we're pretty much set then. But at that point, the other two boys turned up. We're like, where the fuck have you been? And they're like, oh, we've landed over there. And we had to run around the Taliban compound. And they're all shooting at us.
Where's your helicopter?
It's still there. In the
compound?
In the compound. And we're like, well, we're done. You're going to have to run back. and get out. So they kind of turned up. They're all absolutely ball bagged, breathing hard, looking pretty disturbed. And then they turn around and do it all again and get back. Oh, so that was that then. We got on the helicopters and took off and flew back across the river. And that was pretty sad because you could see everyone watching, well, in the distance, you could see them all. And our helicopter's got Corporal Ford hanging limp from beneath it. And I think at that point, everyone knows he's dead. And flew back, landed. Had to, had a cigarette.
Who unbuckled him? Who sorted him out when they got there?
Yeah, I did, and it was hard because I had to direct the helicopter on the landing to make sure we didn't actually land on him.
Yeah. What was the mood like? Those kind of minutes and hours after with the lads. Did you? Kind of get back involved with the blokes who knew him, or were you just back in ops, going about the kind of the more,
I wouldn't say it went straight. It didn't go to normal. No, we didn't just kind of crack on with normal business at all. The mood was pretty low. And there were lots of, you know, you then start thinking through it and you're like, well, you know, what happened to the intelligence? What happened to the attack? You know, it's just, it wasn't a good day.
Go on. Sorry, mate.
Yeah. And then the next morning we had a service in the desert. We had the Padre came down and he said a few words. We fired off one of the light guns into the fort, and I just had a moment to reflect, I guess.
I know it was a process and it was a moving machine. What was going on? But were you proud of your actions on the day? Did you do everything you could? Because it was chaotic.
When I reflect on it, there's lots of things I should have done better. But at the end of the day, you know, I volunteered and we got him back, and I guess that's what matters, isn't it? Yeah.
Debriefing wise, lessons learnt. Was there any kind of military lessons learnt from this? Was there any personal lessons learnt immediately?
Well, I think we stopped calling them lessons learned, didn't we? Lessons identified. Lots of lessons identified. I couldn't say that they were learned. That was 2007. I left beginning of 2009. But hopefully, there was certainly a lot of good material there to reflect on. Everything from the tactics to the leadership to command and control.
You win the Military Cross for the actions on the day. March 2008, you received the Military Cross.
That's right, and then, I did, yeah.
And then a year later, you left. What was the reasons why you left? Was it anything to do with the military? What was the...
No. Listen, I had a brilliant time. I joined the military for the adventure and excitement, and I certainly got that. Not just through that incident, but through all the exercises and courses that I did, and the blokes. You know, working with soldiers is it's a cliche, isn't it? It's a huge privilege, but it is. There's no one more grounded or kind of leveling as a good old fashioned squaddie. You know, they don't. When I moved into Civvy Street, a lot of people said, sometimes at job interviews, they say, well, how are you going to manage? Because you come from the army, you're used to kind of giving instructions and people just do as they're told. That's bollocks. You know, soldiers want to know why they're being asked to close and kill the enemy. They need to know what's going on around them, and they need to be motivated, and they need to feel that the organisation supports them. So, and they're tough. You know, they're tough and they're cheeky and they're gobby, and you've got to be pretty good to manage that and deliver when you're leading high caliber blokes like that. So all of that was brilliant, and I left primarily because I just kind of came to a natural junction, I guess. It was, you know, go on to staff college and do a staff job, or bang out and start life in Civvy Street. And even if you do a full career in the military, you leave at 55. So everyone has to leave eventually. I just judged that it was better to go.
At the point of what we've just discussed, that full conversation, you had no immediate family, so you wasn't married or you had kids. You've got two boys now. Are they... Have you ever told this story to them?
Oh, yeah, loads of times. Yeah. Ham it up a bit. Obviously.
Yeah, put the gruffalo at bedtime. We're on the Dave Riggs, so we're doing the daddy story.
Yeah.
Do they, because it is, I remember when it happened, it ignited everything that you wanted to be and do in the military, this amazing kind of operation. And I remember reading it in The Guardian where they were saying that you the bit where you say there was test firing with a rifle. In The Guardian, they say, these guys were on this Apache and they were firing into the Taliban positions. But it really was an amazing... It will go down in legend, this mini op within an op. And... Yeah, your boys, what are they thinking about it?
I think it's great, yeah. You give them the kind of... Well, you spare them the gory details, obviously, but the general theme is it's a brilliant boys' war story, isn't it? Mm. I don't think it's as inspirational as some of the stories you've covered, but it's a great story. My boys are really, you know, they're just typical lads, and they love a bit of rough and tumble. And I've got this cartoon book that I think Jeremy Clarkson put together, and it was done in partnership with The Sun, and they do a whole cartoon strip of it.
Oh, really?
And they've actually got us kind of strapped into the Hellfire rocket rails, which. So we're like part of the Apache kind of armament.
Yeah. He's nutcase commandos.
They take that book to school and show the teachers, and the teachers like, don't really quite know what to make of it.
But. I mean, there should be pride, but you know, this conversation, it's where you get one side of it from books and articles, but there is some realities of it that you've shown emotion today, but you know, and we can't forget the fact that a lad died in this, and
yeah.
This conversation was always for me, it was about the whole kind of legend around it, but also understanding these fuck ups, and that was part of it all as well. So this overall Apache mission was also you didn't say lesson learned there, but there's a lot to be taken from it. Mate, thanks so much for coming in. And I really appreciate it. It's such a good hour for me and we'll leave it there.
Yeah, good. Thank you, mate. Thank you.